Western allies of being behind the recent riots, saying the riots represented the hybrid war against the Iranian people. The EU says it must act to address, quote, distortions created by Washington's $430 billion plan to spur climate-friendly technologies in the United States. Also ahead, thousands march in Morocco's capital in protest at high cost of living and the repression amid surging inflation and rising social discontent. Welcome. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister has accused the United States and some of its Western allies of being behind the recent riots in the country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, during an official visit to Serbia, said Washington and its allies have always sought to create turmoil in Iran. He said the recent riots were fomented through foreign interference and represented a hybrid war against the Iranian people. He added that one of the goals of Washington through the riots was to get more concessions from Tehran in the negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Amir Abdullahian reiterated that a deal on the JCPOA would be acceptable to Tehran only if it was beneficial to the Iranian nation and durable. The riots in Iran began after the death of young woman Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. As the winter approaches, life is getting harder and harder for the Afghan people. A recent survey shows as many as 98% of the population in Afghanistan rates their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
More than 1 year after the Taliban returned to power, a Gallup survey has found that almost all Afghans, or 98%, rate their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering. The survey shows that the situation is getting worse for Afghans, and they have fully lost hope that their future will be any better.
Absolutely, people are suffering, especially from joblessness, poverty, insecurity, and little access to their basic rights. Their life conditions were grim even before the Taliban takeover, but recently people's hardships have become even worse. Still, we are not sure what the future holds for us.
Currently, Afghan girls and women are dealing with many difficulties, especially their struggle to get education or a job to make ends meet. Poverty has not only affected men, but also the well-being of Afghan women and children. Being relatively barred from public places makes us further desperate.
According to the survey, 9 in 10 Afghans say they find it very difficult to make ends meet. 92% of the respondents say they think it is a bad time to find a job, while 86% say they have been unable to buy themselves food.
Making ends meet has become very difficult. We need to skip some meals to survive. The arrival of the cold season is adding to the people's suffering. With no job and relief assistance, you can imagine how disastrous people's lives can become.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turning elsewhere now, the British government is considering seeking the military's help during planned strikes, including by the National Health Service. The Conservative Party chairman says the government wants minimal disruption to key public services. For months now, Britain has been witnessing back-to-back strikes across different sectors. The action has spread to the health sector, with nurses in England and ambulance workers in England and Wales planning to stop work later this month. Under pressure, the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is reportedly even considering plans to curb the right to strike. Britain's woes are part of the wider economic crisis in Europe. The situation has been triggered by the inflation and the surging energy prices that came on the heels of Western sanctions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Our correspondent in London, Robert Carter, joined us earlier with more details on the strikes in the UK and how the new government is handling it.
You know, things like inflation are on the rise, cost of living, things are more expensive now, and people in many sectors feel as if their wages are not increasing in order to keep up with inflation, with price demand. So public sectors, especially like the NHS, are basically feeling the real squeeze. Their pockets are being pinched very much so, and they feel that they have been there during the hardest times, like, for example, during the COVID lockdown period, the pandemic. They were serving on the front lines, trying to keep people alive during that horrific episode. And what they're essentially rather being rewarded for their dedication and their hard work, they're actually, in their mind, being punished with a lack of support from the government to help get them through this economic crisis, to help basically give them a wage that they can live off of. That's quite frankly it. There are other issues as well, and they're talking about now curbing the rights of people to protest, especially in the public services, because they have a lot of power to shut things down at a time when the government is already trying to push through controversial policies, controversial new laws, controversial new taxes on the horizon, that type of thing. And obviously, if the country just stops working, that proves to be devastating for this new government led by the relatively new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak.
The European Commission chief says the EU must take action to offset distortions made by Washington's new climate and tax laws, a move that could put European goods at a disadvantage on American soil.
So we must take action to rebalance the playing field where the IRA and other measures create distortions. In other words, we need to do our homework here in Europe, and at the same time, we have to work with the United States to mitigate competitive disadvantages.
In a speech in the Belgian city of Bruges, von der Leyen said the EU should adjust its rules to make it easier for public investments in the transition to climate-friendly technologies. Her remarks are in response to Washington's Inflation Reduction Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden in August. The act is designed to promote U.S. manufactured goods and accelerate the transition to a low-carbon economy. Some European governments are alarmed by the laws that allow over $400 billion of subsidies for U.S. manufactured goods. They say the act is a threat to their industries, especially in the energy and auto sectors. Now, the OPEC Plus group of countries have agreed to maintain their current oil output levels. The decision comes in a climate of uncertainty ahead of fresh Western oil sanctions against Moscow. The group, comprising of OPEC members plus 10 other oil producers, decided to stick to their production cut of 2 million barrels per day until the end of next year. The alliance said it was ready to take immediate additional measures to address market developments if necessary. This after the EU and G7 agreed a $60 per barrel price cap on Russian oil, which will come into effect on Monday or soon after. There is also an EU embargo on maritime deliveries of Russian crude oil. Russia has denounced the price cap, threatening to suspend deliveries to any country that adopts the measure. Tensions are running high between the United States and China, as the two have been flexing their military muscles amid a tug of war over international dominance. For our news review program, we reached out to experts who gave us their opinion.
Time now for the news review. The United States suggesting it's ready to use military power to maintain its international dominance that's being challenged by China. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin made a comment as the Pentagon unveiled its latest stealth bomber, B-21 Raider. Austin said that China has both the will and the power to reshape the U.S.-dominated international order, but he warned that Washington won't let that happen. Austin added that the U.S. is aligning its military budget to the China challenge. Washington and Beijing are locked in tensions over a host of issues, including what Beijing calls the threat posed by Washington's strategic shift to East Asia. China also says it is ready to use its military strength to dash attempts to challenge its rising power. Okay, to get some insight, allow me to invite a couple of guests and see what they think about it. So Andrew Leung, independent China special, joined me from Hong Kong. Also with me is Jeff Brown. He's a geopolitical analyst in Normandy, France. Good to see you, John. Now let's go to Andrew first. This is what Defense Secretary Austin said to Andrew, that China does have both the power and the will to do what the U.S. doesn't want to do, to change this U.S.-dominated international order. What would it take for the U.S. to be able to counter this?
Well, the reality remains that China's power is not China's power to challenge the American-dominated international order. It's not in the military. It is China's economic gravitas, particularly its economic interconnectivity with the rest of the world. As far as the military is concerned, the United States remains the world's dominant power because the United States spends on the military multiple times than China, both in aggregate terms and particularly in per capita terms. But above all, it outspends the next almost five countries combined as far as the military expenditure is concerned. Of course, as far as military technology is concerned, America still reigns supreme. Its latest bomber, of course, is the very top range of the state-of-the-art kind of bomber. And China is decades behind the United States. As far as nuclear weapons are concerned, again, the United States has multiple times, almost 10 times, the number of nuclear weapons. And in particular, the United States has got military bases in 800 bases around the world. There is no way that China can really threaten the Americans' dominance. Of course, China's capacity to defend itself has been increasing all the time. But the fact remains that China's challenge is not so much in the military, it's in economics. So the American Defense Secretary's trying to hype up this China threat, which of course is part of this 360 degrees pushback of the United States against China, is really trying to even put more money into the hands of the military, particularly the so-called industrial military complex, which is integral part of the American economic system.
Okay. Now let me ask Jeff this question. Jeff, Austin has said that talking about China's rise, that's an inevitable fact, it's been rising economically, militarily, in every possible way. And he's saying that he's wondering what that means for America's position in the world. So let me put that question to you. What would it mean for America's position in the world with China rising in different aspects?
Well, I would like to point out that what Austin said, the Eisenhower administration was saying the same thing to China back in the 1950s when they were threatening to bomb China with atomic weapons. And this was before China got the atomic bomb and missiles at around 1964 to 1966. And Mao Zedong famously said, go ahead. He actually called their bluff and said, go ahead. If you want to try bombs, A-bombs, we'll just move to the western half of the country and continue on. And that's when he famously called the United States a paper tiger. And yeah. I think that really has changed for China since the 1950s. China is surrounded by dozens of U.S. military bases. China does not have to attack the United States. It only has to defend its own territory. It's the United States that has a supply line of 11,000 kilometers. This is just the typical imperial huff and puff to make the world think that the United States is indomitable and unbeatable and has full spectrum dominance over the over all of humanity. I don't think Xi Jinping and the Politburo or the Central Committee are losing much sleep over this, to be honest with you. It doesn't change anything for them. And I would like to say that I think China's missile technology is highly advanced compared to what it was 10 years ago. And also, China has hypersonic missiles. The United States doesn't even have them yet. Okay. So I don't think China has much to worry about. It's just not going to use a B-21 radar on China. They didn't do it in the 1950s, and they're not going to do it today.
Okay. Thank you so much for the insight. Andrew Leung in Hong Kong, Jeff Brown in France.
Thousands of people have filled the streets of Morocco's capital in protest at the high cost of living amid growing social discontent in the North African country. It is estimated that around 3,000 people from across Morocco converged on central Rabat for the rally staged by left-wing political and trade union organizations. This is the largest rally in recent months in Morocco, which is grappling with inflation, mostly blamed on surging food prices. In the year to October, consumer prices rose by over 7%. But the economic woes are not the only concerns of Moroccans. During the rally, they decried the repression of freedom of expression, as well as corruption in the country. They also expressed anger over the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel in December 2020. And that brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Now, some countries and some international cooperation platforms have begun to coordinate attempts to de-dollarization, such as BRICS. In the context of the weakening U.S. dollar hegemony, developing countries all over the world need a more stable type of financial mechanism as a new channel for conducting financial transactions. The BRICS and other international platforms are trying to work out solutions. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more.
RT in a report wrote, the two nations have been promoting settlements in national currencies, referring to Russia and China. The transition to trade in national currencies between Russia and China will contribute to a global de-dollarization process, China's charged offer in Russia said this week at a conference on Russian-Chinese relations. Sun Weidong said, noting that bilateral trade has risen dramatically, mostly on energy and agricultural supplies, the existing economic partnership between China and Russia and the long-term accumulated level of trade have laid a solid foundation for further deepening cooperation between our countries. Energy cooperation continues to play an important role in relations between the two countries. In addition, agricultural products and seafood from Russia are increasingly entering the Chinese market, the diplomat said, adding, we have cooperation on major projects in the field of nuclear energy, aircraft construction, rocket engines, satellite navigation. In addition, payments are constantly being made in local currencies. Russia and its trading partners have been expanding the share of national currencies in mutual settlements in an attempt to move away from the US dollar and the euro. In recent years, Moscow has been steadily following a policy of de-dollarization of foreign trade, particularly expanding the use of Chinese currency for buying financial products denominated in yuan and using it as a reserve currency. Trade between the two nations hit $136 billion in the first 9 months of this year, jumping by over 30% in annual terms, according to the National Bureau of Statistics of China. Moscow and Beijing aim to increase bilateral trade to a $200 billion target this year. In this regard, Global Times wrote, Egypt will develop a new currency indicator partly to reframe the idea that the Egyptian pound should be pegged to the US dollar, the country's central bank governor said, according to Reuters. As a strong dollar has become a hazard for global economy, economies around the world have realized the urgency of de-dollarization. Many countries have started their own exploration according to their national condition to tackle the impact caused by the U.S. highly reckless and irresponsible financial policy. The new currency indicator of Egypt is a helpful trial among countries aiming for de-dollarization. In order to tackle the spillover impacts from the U.S. tightened monetary policy on other countries, many countries across the world have started their de-dollarization exploration in ways including using bilateral and multilateral currency agreements to settle transactions in international trade, promoting the diversification of foreign exchange reserves, and reducing U.S. Treasury holdings. De-dollarization is not a voluntary choice made by countries such as Egypt, but a forced response to the weaponization of the dollar. The strong U.S. dollar policy exacerbating serious inflation, currency devaluation, and capital outflow in developing countries. To avoid being dragged into a crisis, de-dollarization has become an increasing priority for those nations. Admittedly, it is not an easy task to avoid being pulled into a financial crisis caused by the dollar. There still remain uncertainties in their efforts to cope with current financial problems. They still face mounting challenges in how to maintain financial market and foreign trade stability and take proper measures and steps to avert a crisis. Ending dollar hegemony in the world is not an easy goal, but the process has already begun, and momentum will become more obvious and stronger over time. and more countries join. It is now necessary for the world to explore how different countries should work together to coordinate their efforts to address the common challenge of the U.S. dollar hegemony and maintaining the stability of the world monetary system while de-dollarization gathers pace. Now, some countries and some international cooperation platforms have begun to coordinate attempts on de-dollarization, such as BRICS. In the context of the weakening U.S. dollar hegemony, developing countries all over the world need a more stable type of financial mechanism as a new channel for conducting financial transactions. The BRICS and other international platforms are trying to work out solutions. In June, Russia proposed at a BRICS-related meeting that it is advancing the development of a reserve currency based on the BRICS basket of currencies. As early as 2019, Germany, the UK, and France established the INTEC system to help European companies bypass US dollar settlements, and now more and more countries have joined the system. In Asia, the Central Bank of India launched a rupee settlement mechanism for international trade in July. Five ASEAN economies reached a consensus in July to plan to establish a regional integrated payment network to bypass the US dollar for direct foreign exchange settlements. It is worth exploring how all parties should strengthen global coordination. Strengthening global coordination for de-dollarization is fundamentally a political decision, not an economic one, for many economies around the world. Facing the new geopolitical landscape and the impact of a strong dollar, countries across the world should take a longer-term view and strive to strengthen de-dollarization coordination.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, this is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the pleasure to be the host of this episode of Point of View. I am Beat at your service, and with me I have two dear guest speakers, my dear brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And my dear brother, Muhammad, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure too to have you in here in this controversial discussion, which I'm really interested in. So we're going to go through our topic today, which is actually voluntary public forces, that we call it as BASIJ in our own country, which is a kind of a voluntary group of people who work in different domains, as you know. First of all, I want you to tell me the philosophy and actually the comments that you have on this domain, and then we're going to go through the practical parts in other domains which contain this matter. What is the philosophy of this public force?
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam and his immaculate progeny. Well, voluntary public forces, or what they are namely called, besieged forces in our country, actually is a social movement that it can happen in every society or in every community in different situations and due to different circumstances. I think if we want to have a look at the philosophy of such movements and such, let's say, public voluntary movements, it is exactly as the late Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, that it is exactly what happened at the time of the Holy Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. We know that at the Medina of that day, people, the Muslims, were usually gathered in the masjid, Masjid al-Nabi, the mosque of the Holy Prophet, and they came to solve the problems of the Islamic Ummah, and they gave even consulting to the Holy Prophet. The Prophet was using their ideas, their viewpoints, and actually shared his own viewpoints with them. And in case he wanted to tell them something important, he gathered the people at the masjid, and people were there. I mean, they actually usually attended for the congregations, and then it was a good center for making big and important decisions. So when Imam Rahmatullah alayhi salam was asked that what is this Basij and what is the philosophy of the Basij, he says this is not something new. It was exactly something that was in the dawn of Islam. The youth of the society, when the youth of the Islamic Ummah were ready and were actually prepared to do whatever is needed, any action which was needed for the betterment of the position of the Islamic Ummah. So it was actually an innovation in this century that was done by the late Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi in 1970s. And he called it, and he gave it the title of Basij, what we call it, public voluntary forces. So this is exactly what, was practiced at that time, the dawn of Islam. But it can have different functions. So the Basij can sometimes actually have some functions like what they did at the time of war, the imposed war between Iraq and Iran. And if you ask every single person in this country what was one of the mysteries of the victory of Iranian nation in that war, and while all the other countries of the world were in one front of the battle and only Iran alone was in the other side, so they might tell you that, yes, if it was not the help and the, let's say, the that good function and functionality of these forces, we would not succeed in reaching to this victory. So at the time of peace, again, they might have another function, not necessarily a military function. At that time, which was the time of war, it had that function. So at the time of peace, they might have some other functions like that. Like what? Like cultural activities. Right after the war, these brothers or sisters who were involved in Basij issues or this public voluntary forces, they tried to work on the culture of the Islamic Ummah, and they did lots of works, in different areas. Again, we reached to the time of the corona outbreak. Again, they came to help the people with vaccination of a variety range of the classes of the society with their vaccinations in different groups and in different projects, namely the project of Shahid Soleimani. So they actually did the vaccination, I think, in no time. I think in less than 3 months, they tried to vaccinate almost
70% of the population.
Almost 60-70% of the population.
Yeah.
So it was the kind of work that these actually groups of people have been doing.
Thank you for your elaboration about these public voluntary forces. The thing I want to tell you is that, as you know, there is a long history before these public voluntary forces, from the first to actually appearance of Islam up to here. We had this public voluntary forces, but the thing is, as you know, at a present time, we are somehow more developed than, for example, 1400 years ago. So the usage of public voluntary forces is, I think, somehow weakened. So there should be a kind of a strong motivation for people, for the public, to go through these voluntary aids for people, not only aids, but also any movement which is considered as public voluntary force. The thing I want to ask you is that, what is their motivation, the public motivation, for actually making these voluntary forces at a time that we have enough resources, I think, and actually we are more developed than, for example, 1400 years ago?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To answer your question, as a matter of fact, because you brought in this historical aspect of Basij, saying that now it's becoming more archaic with the, and it's probably not really in line with the modern ways that we might have. I'd also like to, in answering this question, I'd also like to correct my brother here, Brother Ali. You see, it's not the invention of the noble prophet, the Basij, this public voluntary forces, was not really the invention of the noble prophet. Rather, it's the way that God carried out his mission. So we can say it's a reinvention of the through Imam Khomeini for Iranian revolution. But even before that, all the prophets had this way of godly bringing the people voluntarily. And then this is, again, we can use the ayah, La ikraha fid-deen. So they would come and teach the people in the first instance. First of all, prove that they are the loyal people to God Almighty, that they are the persons that are the real role models. And when this has been proven, they will bring the people, mobilize the people around themselves voluntarily again. And it's the people, it's the public. And the big difference between the tyrannic forces and the tyrannic governments, the tyrannic way of living, is normally they have coup d'etats. If you look at how the tyrannical forces came into power, look at how America came into power.
Yeah.
They came from Europe, they entered into the U.S., and they butchered whoever was in the lands. Instead of, you know, maybe if it was like an Islamic mission, it would have been a mission of guidance. Going there, not really butchering the people, but rather guiding them towards an ultimate source of life. Right. So this way of mobilizing people towards one ultimate goal was the way that God Almighty has taught the prophets, and after the prophets, the ulama too, and the imams and the ulama too, bring the people together. And if you ask me the question, what were the other ulamas doing before Imam Khomeini, that Imam Khomeini eventually used this, you know, basij, or this public voluntary force, as a tool to start his Islamic mission, they were developing this public voluntary forces. If you look at from the time of the Ghaybat of Imam Mahdi until Imam Khomeini, you will see every single scholar, every single imam, from Sheikh Mufid, Sheikh Saduq, all these people, they come together. Their goal was to essentially, if you look at each one of these people, they're trying to get the people, their core mission is to get the people, mobilize the people voluntarily, and then prepare them for a greater movement. So this way has been proven, not only in these 1400 years that you mentioned, but even before that. From the beginning of the history, where as far as mankind can trace the records, it has been proven. And even after these 1400 years, when Imam Khomeini has reinitiated this mission, using the Basij, using the public voluntary force that was prepared and brought by the other scholars before him, he used this, and then he was able to successfully start a big Islamic mission. And it wasn't without this force that he did this mission. So even after the revolution, as my brother mentioned, you will see that this force not only helped in the military area, but also helped in areas such medical areas. And generally in every area where the country might feel there is a need for, outside of the governance structure, Basij would enter and selflessly help the people. And it's still this way still proves to be the valid and the more correct way of doing it.
You're telling me that there is a strong connection between these kind of leaders, these people who just persuade other people to come for this aid and for helping others in different aspects. But the thing I want to ask you right now is that, how about non-Islamic countries? Do they have other leaders like that? Or they literally have public voluntary forces or something like that? Or no, they are trying to have something like this. What is the story about
that? Yeah, they tried. If you look at the Arab uprising, the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring recently, that's what they were trying to do in Egypt and in Tunisia and stuff. The people themselves, though, you see, you have to consider the strong leadership as well. What lacked, in my opinion, in this Arab Spring was the proper leadership. And that's what made it just, you know, go away in that instance. And it had a lot of negative effects as well. With a proper leadership and this public voluntary force, a movement would be successful. And you brought up the question about more modern ways. The best and the most way of, you know, more ethically approaching a movement is through a public voluntary force.
Yeah.
Other ways, you see coup d'etat, you see, for example, military takeover of a government, of a movement. These are not ethical. These are forces.
I want to add a complimentary point to the explanations of the brother. And just to cover your previous and this question of yours. Actually, you said that it might not work today because we are highly developed and the countries or, I don't know, communities might not be in need of such.
Not only these, but I think the modern civilization, the modern society is somehow more selfish than the past time. Mm-hmm. And also this is the main problem.
Exactly. I wanted to say that this movement itself is something against selfishness of the societies because it is something that brings people to involve for their own affairs. So this is the involvement of masses of the nation for their own sakes, right? So do you think that people would get stuck in case they are just for your own affair, for your family, for the people in your vicinity? You are going to do a service and give a service to the people around.
Yeah.
See, that's why they are motivated with this, actually, motivation that this is something for the betterment of the life of other Muslims or other, let's say, neighbors of yours. So we see that it's still today, it's still this concept and this movement is valid and it works. And to this question of yours that you asked lastly, on the other countries, are they able to have such a thing? I think when we have taken this model from Islam, I mean, a model from the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, so it means that all Muslim countries and even non-Muslim countries can take some lessons from that.
Yeah, we have seen that, for example. It comes from a godly source.
Yeah, it comes from a divine and godly source. Then look, as we saw in the history that many leaders of the world have taken their lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, from the kind of, let's say, freedom and freedom seeking that he injected to the soul of the people after him. You see, we have some people who are not following Islam and they are not actually Muslims in general, but Muslims at all, but they are actually saying that they have taken their lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The same way that people from, specifically from Islamic Ummah, to take their lesson from the Holy Prophet and to involve people in their own affairs. In case you see a Muslim country is needless of such movement and activity, we have to doubt. It means that there is a, let's say, gap between the let's say administration and the nation.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode. This is all the time we had. I wish you enjoyed the discussion of today. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, except I. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The recent state visit to Washington by French President Emmanuel Macron highlights the weaknesses of the relationship between the United States and the European Union as a whole. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted U.S. President Joe Biden met with French President Emmanuel Macron at the White House. The White House brought out all the ceremonial objects it could think of while. All this had a slightly unreal feeling. It was a strong contrast with the rift between the U.S. and France on various issues and the criticism of the U.S. Macron made before his trip. And from the French public reaction, it is clear that France wants more than just this spectacular event. Just over a year ago, France was badly betrayed by the U.S. As a result of Washington's moves, Australia unilaterally cancelled the major submarine deal with France, worth tens of billions of Australian dollars, and turned instead to the U.S. for sale. Before Paris had even recovered from the shock and anger, Washington struck again. Biden signed the CHIP Act and Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, into law. Although they nominally target China, many countries, including France, feel threatened by it. Macron described the IRA as a super aggressive thing toward European companies. In other words, for Paris, the scars from old wounds have not yet healed, and now new wounds are being inflicted. How can France forget the pain just because of a few hugs and smiles from the White House? This is just a thin piece of paper over deep cracks and wounds. It is not even a band-aid. It is believed that France will not be so naive and innocent, having already suffered a loss. At Macron's insistence, Biden said he was willing to make some changes for U.S. allies regarding the IRA. He did not make any detailed commitments, nor did he hint that he would give up subsidies, only saying that it is a matter to be worked out. But everyone knows that phrase is nothing more than a perfunctory delaying tactic. It could not have been more evident when Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat with close ties to Biden, told the media that Macron's U.S. visit could not produce miracles for European manufacturers. It needs to be emphasized that this is a matter of principle. It is neither a question of whether France or the EU is easily coaxed, nor should it be a private exchange of interest between the US and France or the EU. France and the EU have a responsibility to stand up against protests and boycott US behaviors, which flagrantly violates the rules of the WTO, not just because their own interests are harmed. Even if France and the EU have received the corresponding compensation from the US, if they are satisfied or accept the US plan to treat the EU differently from other economies, then this means France and the EU retreat from the principles they have always insisted on, losing their morality for the chance of slim profits. This is the result that the international community does not want to see. The fair rules of world trade cannot be broken, and they need to be jointly upheld by all. These two events have not only brought unpleasant memories to France and the EU, but also reshaped their external perceptions. Washington hopes that Europe will wholeheartedly act as the plasticine that meets the needs of the US national interest.
It is expected to maintain a high degree of unity with the U.S. when facing the U.S. competitors and is best divided when facing the U.S. itself. The U.S. worldview is highly unilateral and hegemonic, but Europe has benefited from multilateralism and is a staunch supporter of multilateralism. It does not want to be completely tied to the tracks of the U.S. new Cold War. The self-awareness shown from time to time in Europe, especially in France and Germany, makes the dominating and pragmatic U.S. feel uncomfortable. So it often bypasses Europe to find more obedient partners, which then makes Europe feel abandoned and oppressed. The transatlantic relationship is currently in a critical historical period. The steel frame of the bridge supporting it has been severely loosened. The U.S. has neither the will nor the ability to repair it. Washington's current approach is to bypass some of Europe's core concerns, use the so-called consensus to lure Europe, then frighten it with some risks, such as the challenge to the common values of the U.S. and Europe, geopolitical competitions and dependence on the industrial chain. We have noticed that Biden and Macron issued a joint statement after the talks, saying that the two sides should coordinate on concerns regarding China's challenge. They also mentioned peace and stability across the Taiwan Straits by specifically mentioning China in their bilateral relations. The displayed unity between the U.S. and France is proven to be false and mixed with impure and even poisonous intentions. We have no idea when and to what extent Europe will be taken hostage by this low-cost cooperation with the U.S. But it is certain that Europe's compromise on this consensus cannot be exchanged for true friendship with the U.S. It is not like the blue cheese at the White House state dinner, which can be shared happily. On the contrary, it is more like a bowl of ecstasy soup made specifically for Europe by Washington. Meanwhile, the website of Responsible Statecraft wrote, "The state visit to Washington this week by President Emmanuel Macron of France highlights the weaknesses of the relationship between the United States and the European Union as a whole. These have their roots in the enduring truth of the famous remark by former Belgian Foreign Minister Mark Eyskens that the EU is an economic giant, a political dwarf, and a military worm. Worms are by nature both invertebrate and brainless, and the European dwarf suffers not just from height issues, but multiple personality disorder. The giant, however, has a mind and body of its own. The problem for the Biden administration is that precisely because the EU remains an economic giant, it is chiefly in the area of economics that Biden will be asking Macron to help generate European support, and this is an area where the EU has often shown both the ability and the will to resist U.S. pressure. It is also in the decline of European economies, not military threats to Europe, that the real dangers to European liberal democracy are situated. The Russia-Ukraine conflict has led to a wave of decisions by European NATO members to boost their military spending. But even if these promises are kept, it will take a considerable time for them to lead to serious improvements in capability. At most, they will allow European countries to supply more arms to Ukraine without draining their own reserves. Moreover, European militaries are too a considerable extent irrelevant as far as present U.S. strategy is concerned. There appears to be no chance of European governments sending their troops to fight in Ukraine. As for European military deployments against China, it is already clear that these will remain purely symbolic. The website of Responsible Statecraft continued, "Tensions are worsened by increasingly bitter divisions between EU members over the sharing of the resulting energy shortages and economic suffering between different EU members. Resentment of America is also growing at the fact that due to domestic fracking, U.S. gas prices are a fraction of European ones, so that the suffering of the U.S. public as a result of the war is limited. Macron has accused American and Norwegian energy producers of exploiting the crisis to earn super profits from exports to Europe. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire has said that U.S. exporters are using the energy crisis to further U.S. economic domination and weaken Europe. The Economist has estimated that the steep increase in electricity prices may lead to 147,000 more deaths in Europe this winter compared to previous years. European opinion over the next few months will be shaped by whether the winter is harsh or mild, and the impact on energy supplies, mass suffering, and mass unrest are serious or limited in the consequence. Additional strain on the U.S.-EU relationship has been placed by the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act, which provides large tax credits for American, but only American, producers of electric cars and alternative energy. The EU has labeled this unfair discrimination and is demanding that these de facto subsidies should be extended to European producers as well. Macron has raised this issue in his talks with Biden. A U.S.-EU task force on the IRA has been created, but there are few signs as yet of its leading to any new agreement.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.